This episode of Commentary, Trek Stars, is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hi, this is Robert Duncan McNeil, also known as Tom Paris from Star Trek Voyager. You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 3, Episode 20 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And today is Part 3 in our series on Cliff Bohl and his work on The X-Files, where we are going to be looking at his second X-File, Bad Blood. Now, this episode aired in Season 5. It was the 12th episode of Season 5. It aired on February 22nd, 1998. Mm-hmm. And it is considered by many to be one of, if not the best episode of the entire show.
It's certainly a great episode.
And in fact, if you look at the Geos ratings, it is number one. So you could say it's the best of both worlds.
You
of
could.
The X-Files.
You could do that.
Yeah. So, would you like to give a synopsis of this episode?
Sure. Bad Blood's kind of a weird X-Files episode in that it sort of departs from the format. But the way in which it departs from the format is by showcasing the format in a really strange way. Essentially, there's a small town where there have been some deaths. And Mulder believes that it's the work of vampires. And Scully obviously doesn't agree with that. And the story is told from the perspective of both of them recounting the experiences because of how bizarre the case was and how unconvincing the conclusion is, and that they really don't exactly know what happened. So there's this weird sort of like Rashomon type thing where we get to see the story from two different points of view, Mulder making it really funny and Scully making it equally funny in a different way. And the reality that we see sort of through the both of them is that it's a little bit of both. And it is incredibly entertaining.
Yes.
It is one of the most fun episodes. And if you're an X-Files fan, it's one of those episodes that it doesn't come up very often in like conversations about the best episodes of the show. Until you really get down into it and talk about the details and what makes it good. And I'm impressed at how high it is on the Geos rating, because I would have imagined that, no, of course not. They would, I mean, like, other episodes would be way higher, but it actually shows a great amount of thought went into their rating system.
Well, I mean, when you talk about the X-Files, you know, we talked about this last week, too, and how generally speaking, the comedy episodes were always good, you know, and they were always fun, and it was nice to have a departure from, you know, what could sometimes be a very, very dark and serious show, you know, and lots of times there was a lot of, you know, sort of like, the show was essentially, you know, film noir, and they're one of the elements of noir is having this sort of very fatalistic outlook of the world, and lots of times this show sort of had that outlook, like we're all screwed, you know, it's just that's the way it is, and you know, the government and aliens have conspired to keep us down and have covered it up so that we don't even know about it, and there's really nothing that we can do. We are just little people in a very, very, very big machine. And it's basically impossible for us to fight back, no matter how hard we try. And even our biggest fights are going to amount to a very, very, very small step forward, which is still rather insignificant in the grand scheme of things. And
virtually every plot line does involve, like, one or two steps forward.
Right.
And but one and between one in like 17 steps backward.
Yeah. Well, what it is you take one or two steps forward, and then
someone dies,
and then you realize just when you think you're reaching the finish line, you realize that the finish line is actually another 26 miles ahead.
You know? Or it's just like a fake line painted on a wall.
Yeah.
And then you're like, what? I thought, oh, no. Did I make it wrong? Oh, man.
Yeah. And that's a very noirish thing to do. And, you know, you need to break that up. I mean, there are some shows which don't break it up. There are some shows which, you know, are, you know, day in and day out, literally, that. You know, 24 is that. And there's really sort of no release valve in that type of thing. And the X-Files definitely had that, and these comedy episodes were that. You know, it is sort of a lighthearted look at the same types of stories, but with the stakes, no pun intended, not being nearly as high as they usually are.
Yeah, they also usually focused primarily on Mulder and Scully and their relationship,
mm-hmm.
which really helped the show a lot, not just in those episodes, but in, like, every episode. Bad Blood is a great Mulder and Scully's relationship episode.
Yeah.
And those kinds of things strengthen the show on the whole. And when that happens, I mean, like, you can say that Bad Blood's a great episode, but more importantly than that, it made the other episodes better.
Yeah, and what's interesting about this episode is that it does expand on the characters and their relationship with each other by basically showing what they think of each other, what their take is on the other person, you know?
Yes, but there is sort of a sense that they are kind of screwing with each other.
Yeah, I guess.
That they don't exactly see it that way, but they're trying to stick it to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they can't stick it to each other.
Yeah.
So they've got to use some proxy for it.
Yeah. So this episode, you know, once again, just like with Small Potatoes, it was written by Vince Gilligan, who we talked about last week, went on to create Breaking Bad and wrote a number of, you know, really, really good episodes of The X-Files as well. And, you know, Cliff Bohl. Obviously, the teaming worked on Small Potatoes, and so they, I'm guessing, hired him for this episode to try to recapture that magic, which makes sense. And it totally worked. But here they pushed it even further. It's much crazier than Small Potatoes, and in terms of both style and tone, it's pushing the envelope basically as far as you possibly can in this series.
Yes, it also is an incredibly strange thing to do, because they do kind of... It is an episode in which they take the format and the structure of an X-Files episode and do it correctly,
mm-hmm.
but in a weird, slightly different, askew way. And it actually shows a great depth of understanding of the show in order to be able to do that effectively, because if he wasn't good at this, it wouldn't be Mulder and Scully recount the story. It would be the crazy departure because Mulder and Scully don't know how to talk about things.
Right.
It works on multiple levels.
Yeah,
it's shockingly good.
It's done as a slapstick comedy, but it's framed in such a way that it makes sense in the overall show. I mean, the very first scene in the episode is really interesting because it's a very X-Files scene. It opens like a lot of X-Files episodes do, with, you know, a victim mm-hmm. being chased by an unknown assailant, and through the woods. I mean, the photography and everything, it's like straight up, you know, regular X-Files. You know, the middle of the night, this guy is being chased. And, you know, as soon as he's tracked down, you know, there's a stake to the heart and, you know, killing him. And then it's revealed that the person who killed him was Mulder.
Yep.
Which then right there, okay, I mean, that's an interesting little twist, but they still don't really tip their hand yet as to what direction they're going in until Mulder pulls, or Scully, I think it is, pulls out the victim's false fangs.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're given one of the best outros to a teaser in X-Files history, I think, where Mulder is cut off from saying, oh, shit, by the opening theme music.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. Great moment.
It really is hilarious because there is a definite sense that Mulder just killed the dude.
Uh-huh.
Because that dude, he thought that dude was a vampire.
Right.
And you think, wow, that's the kind of thing Mulder would do. And that's the kind of thing that would ruin his life.
And really, like, until he says, oh, you could easily spin that in a different way so that it would become like a serious, you know, like almost, you know, courtroom drama type of episode. This could have easily been the court martial episode of the X-Files.
The cut tells you that it's not the Mulder goes in front of like the disciplinary board and gets fired episode.
Right.
It's the episode where Mulder might get fired episode because
But you also know at that point that this is going to be a weird episode and this is going to be one of the comedy episodes of the show.
Yeah. That's not to say, because there's comedy in basically all of the episodes.
Yeah, all the episodes have funny moments, but there's some where, like, the tone is definitely like, we're doing a comedy this week, you know?
Yeah, and there's the peculiar thing is that usually those episodes are very, very dramatically sound. They're actually so, their structure is so good as a thriller
mm-hmm.
that it's odd they didn't just make it as tense and exciting a thriller as they could. They went a different way.
Yeah.
Which I guess it's just another example of the maturity of the series. They knew when they were doing something good, so they went and did more.
Well, but they also know, and I mean, this is something that, you know, we've discussed elsewhere, I think, a lot, you know, and the idea that, you know, you can use comedy to get your point across sometimes more effectively than drama. And lots of times, if you play something straight, it may not work as well as if you play something comedically. The points that you're trying to make, maybe it's just a formal thing. Maybe it's that it would be boring as a drama. I don't know, but you know, you can certainly use comedy as a way of, you know, making your point more effectively than drama in certain instances.
Sure, but there's always the temptation to go, to play it straight,
yeah,
to make it the obvious thing, and the show very rarely did the obvious thing, which was very smart.
And kind of like what you're saying, you know, the other thing about, I think, most of the comedy episodes, including this one, is if you did take out all the comedy, it would still be sound as a straight episode of the X-Files.
That's what I'm saying. Like some of the really dark, the most tense, like serious straight drama thriller episodes have a less perfectly structured story
mm-hmm.
than the comedy episodes.
Yeah.
Which is, it kind of makes sense, but that's not usually the way TV works.
Yeah. Okay, so we've established that this is one of the best episodes and one of the best comedies in the show, but would you say that it is, like, the most over-the-top episode of the show? I can't really
over
think...
Over-the-top?
Well, I mean, you know, like...
Absolutely not.
What do you think is...
Hollywood AD.
Really?
Hollywood AD is the most over-the-top.
Hmm. But, okay, so perhaps it's not. But certainly at the time it was. You know, there was probably the only one which would come close to it up to this point would have been like Jose Chung's From Outer Space, or maybe...
Which also is kind of like a freaky episode,
mm-hmm.
where there are things that are funny, but also really just bizarre scenario. Yeah. Bad Blood's actually got kind of an oddly straightforward narrative,
mm-hmm.
which helps it be kind of silly, but it's not a radical departure from the format of the show.
Yeah, the narrative itself is straightforward. It's the way that it's told, which is
mm-hmm.
unconventional. And it does have, you know, like you were saying, the sort of Rashomon thing going on where there's the two different perspectives from the story, and that's interesting. And the fact that it doesn't have a thing which you often find in those types of stories where they say, like, well, that's how it could have happened, and this is how it could have happened, but this is what really happened. We never see what really happened. We still have to piece it together just like they do. You know, there isn't that third perspective which plays it straight, you know?
Right. There are clues, though. There are commonalities between
sure.
the narratives.
Yeah, I mean, like you can piece it together.
It's actually kind of odd because the audience can piece together the narrative flow better than, you know, their boss.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just how it goes.
That's because their boss didn't have the brilliant direction of Cliff Bull to observe.
Or, you know, any footage of the events at all.
But speaking of which, the direction in this episode, I thought, was extremely well done. And again, it's another case of Bull getting to do something more than he would have had the opportunity to do working on a show like Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
More so even than Small Potatoes. There's a lot of cool stuff that you can do when, first off, you're given the opportunity to show something in a fantasy setting. And by that I mean, you know, a story which is being told and not necessarily events which are supposed to be portrayed in an accurate light. You know what I mean?
Not really. That sentence kind of got away from you.
Okay. What I mean is, if you look at the first scene, it's a very straightforward X-Files type of scene, and the information which is presented should be taken at face value. Whereas, you know, when you get into the rest of the episode and the story is being told from either Mulder or Scully's perspective, you can take a lot more creative liberties because not every element has to hit as being true. You can do things
yeah.
Which are fictional, which are, you know, sort of fantasy-based.
At the same time, the words being spoken are probably fairly accurate.
Maybe.
The actual sequence of events is probably pretty close to the actual sequence of events that you would mm-hmm. get if you transcribed the events. It's just there are little like differences of tone that make it unique.
Yeah, that's something that I was thinking about while watching the episode, and, you know, thinking about, like, how this episode would look on paper, and how, like you're saying, that the dialogue, for example, probably didn't change much from one perspective to the other,
yeah.
even though they play very, very differently. And there's another example where, you know, aside from kind of the visual side of it, which is what I was sort of talking about, it's also very sort of reliant on the direction of the actors to get across the point that the writer is trying to make.
Yeah, there's a part of me that, like, when I'm talking about Cliff Bull's role in this episode is like I know that he was a great director, but I honestly have no idea how they knew that he could do this.
Maybe it was Small Potatoes.
Yeah, but I mean, like, I don't know. Like, there's just so much weird in this episode, and it's weird in such an indefinable way that I don't know how any of the producers of the X-Files knew that Cliff Bull would know how to do this.
Because
mm-hmm. it's super weirdly, oddly different than other things. Obviously, you can do stuff funny, but it's a particular sort of, like, logical structure to funny in this episode that you don't see very often.
Well, I imagine that there's a number of things at play there. First and foremost, I think, you know, looking at his work on small Potatoes, and who knows...
Potatoes.
Yes, who knows exactly what was in the script based on what ended up on screen. But I could totally see, especially since it's the same writer, I could see Vince Gilligan watching the finished product and being like, man, that guy totally got what I was going for, or maybe even did a better job than what I had initially intended. And since this is sort of like my next foray into this genre, I'm going to get him back because I trust him with my material.
Yeah.
That's one scenario that I can see. Another scenario that I can see is looking at his work on Small Potatoes in addition to his body of work on the whole. You know, I mean, we really aren't familiar with him outside of Star Trek, but he did direct something like 250 hours of television.
Yeah.
So I imagine, you know, there are things, especially if he's trying to get certain jobs, he probably has different types of reels where he's like, well, look at this, you know?
Yeah.
I can totally do that. So, I mean, I can see that happening. And also probably just them knowing him personally, you know, knowing his sensibilities and whatnot.
So that, I assume, is the main factor.
Yeah.
Because I like if you're looking through his catalog of things that you've seen for evidence of
mm-hmm.
his savvy with humor,
yeah,
you're not going to find a lot because he just didn't. Maybe. He did a lot of serious stuff.
Maybe not. Maybe they wanted someone who did a lot of serious stuff so that, you know, you'd have that, since it's kind of like playing off of that, you know. I imagine right. If you got just like a sitcom director, it wouldn't have worked nearly as well because you wouldn't have that. That serious undertone or counterbalance.
It depends on the individual. These days, sure. You couldn't really say that. These days, you could say like, oh yeah, maybe those sitcom guys could do a superhero movie.
Yeah, maybe. You never know. So yeah, I mean that I thought was really interesting. I thought he did an excellent job with the direction, and I also was very impressed with the editing. I'm sure a lot of that was sort of built into the script, but you know, for one thing, balancing the two perspectives and shooting and cutting them in a certain way in order to present it from one person's point of view.
Yeah.
But then also, you know, little things like the time cuts when Scully is doing the autopsy and weighing the various organs and stuff like that. I mean, the comic timing in that sequence and in the episode on the whole is very, very good. And that's something that we talked about with Small Potatoes. It's even better here. I mean, there's like one shot where, I mean, doing the jump cuts to the different organs is great, but there's one shot where she puts the large intestine onto the scale and then she says her dialogue, and then just by happenstance the intestine starts falling off of the scale, and just the out point on that is so perfect. Just, I mean, it's one of those weird little, you know, nerdy things that, you know, most people probably would never notice. And I'm sure I didn't notice the first
the
time I saw it, but
there's a certain like voodoo to like where to cut.
Mm-hmm.
And when you find that like a particular cut is extremely informative or amusing, it's impossible to figure out how they knew.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I mean, would you know if you were editing it? No, of course not.
Who knows what it was, but
it would be miraculous.
Yeah. But it worked so well. It was like there just long enough, but not too long, you know?
Right. It tells you what happened.
Yeah.
But it doesn't show you it.
Mm-hmm. That worked really well. So on the whole, final thoughts on Bad Blood? You a fan?
I'm a huge fan. There's a million episodes of The X-Files that like I get excited about when I'm watching the show. I've done a complete rewatch of the show a handful of times. And when I close in on certain episodes, I get excited about seeing them. And the first rewatch of The X-Files, when it started coming out on DVD, I didn't remember how good Bad Blood was. And when I watched it again, totally, my opinion of it just went completely crazy. I was like, oh my god, that episode's fantastic, that's amazing. And I would bring it up to people who remember the show, and they were like, oh yeah, that was really good. But it didn't have flying saucers in it, so it kind of tended to get lost in the shuffle of X-Files episodes' memory.
Yeah.
But it really does hold up better than most episodes of the show.
Yeah. Yeah, I pretty much agree with that. You know, when I watched the show for the first time, like I had said last week, it was during season 5. So I was recording all of season 5 while watching seasons 1 through 4.
Yeah.
And since all of those seasons had already existed and all of my friends really had already watched the show, I had a certain expectation going into most of the episodes, at least the really big ones, based on what my friends were saying, you know.
And like, Bad Blood doesn't come up.
It didn't come up, well, because it didn't air yet, you know. I mean, my friends were seeing Bad Blood pretty much the same time that I was seeing it. So everyone was like, Jose Chung's from Outer Space is great, you know. I mean, anytime Darren Morgan's in there, it's great, you know. Even in Small Potatoes, he's in it. He didn't write it, but he's in it. So that one's pretty great too. So I had sort of a certain mindset going into the show, and because I had that going into the first four seasons, and then I was basically going into the fifth season blind, I didn't start watching Bad Blood thinking that it was one of the best episodes. I was just watching it thinking I was watching the next episode of The X-Files. And because of that, I think my perspective was skewed for years, you know. I always liked it. I always thought it was really good. But, of course, it's not as good as Jose Chung's from Outer Space, you know. Watching it now, I think it is as good as Jose Chung's from Outer Space. I think it might even be better. It might be, you know, the best episode of the show. Maybe not. But it's certainly up there.
Yeah, it's difficult for me to like proclaim the best episode of the show, mainly because there's just too many good ones.
Yeah, I mean, to me...
It's kind of crazy. So I don't want to do that.
Yeah, if I were to do that, I mean, it would be the movie, probably, for me.
Well, that's just wrong.
Yeah, I love the movie.
Your opinion is wrong about that.
Okay. I really, really love that movie. Anyway, well, that's Bad Blood. Let's shift gears for a second here. And sort of touch on something in current events on commentary Trek stars. You know, there is no Star Trek going on right now, but there are plenty of Star Trek creators who are out there doing their own thing. And one rather significant one came up in the past couple weeks. So I figured we should talk about that a little bit, because everyone else is. So why shouldn't we? That's Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, which is the new science show on the Fox network. It's got a lot of Star Trek alums in there. Seth MacFarlane, who, of course, showed up in a few episodes in Enterprise. And
a long-standing Star Trek fan.
A long-standing Star Trek fan. It's also got their little... Ship of the Imagination, or whatever they call it, is what do they call that? What do they call their spaceship?
Oh yeah, there is a name. I don't know what the name is. It's a ridiculous looking spaceship.
It's like spaceship wonder.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because if you've watched the original Cosmos, like almost all the same pieces are there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that they've updated it in a lot of different ways. The original Cosmos, Carl Sagan actually is on a spaceship for a lot of it.
Yeah.
And it looks kind of like Stanley Kubrick designed the Enterprise Bridge.
Yeah.
Because it's just kind of weird and sparse. But this new one is very, very artistic and abstract.
Yeah.
But it's really cool looking.
The new one, it kind of looks like the, kind of looks like Padme's ship from Star Wars Episode One, where it's all mirrored,
kind of Padme's ship meets Slave One.
Yeah, yeah.
Meets the ship. Actually, you know what? It looks a heck of a lot like the ship from Flight of the Navigator.
Okay, all right. But regardless, the reason why I bring up the ship is because it was designed by Ryan Church, who is the guy who designed the Enterprise for the new movies for the JJ verse.
Yeah.
So there's another Star Wars, Star Trek.
Really?
Excuse me. So there's another Star...
You have to cut that out.
Yeah, perhaps. Maybe I'll just leave it in. So there's another Star Trek alum. But the big one, of course, is Brannon Braga, who... I don't know if he's running the show, really, or what he's doing, because, I mean, the first two episodes are not written by him. However... He is an executive producer on the show, and the first episode is directed by him.
Well, he's not a scientist.
he's not a scientist, but he's also not a director, or at least he isn't until now.
Well, I mean, like, it makes sense for him to be involved in well, like, who's structuring
the show. Okay, well, let me ask you that, because I know the first two episodes were written by two people, Anne Dryan, who is...
Druyan.
Is it Druyan? Okay.
I thought it was Druyan.
Druyan, whatever. Druyen. I assumed it was Dryan, but regardless, she is Carl Sagan's wife,
yep.
Right? And she, I know, had a hand in writing a lot of the stuff that he wrote. Like, she had a hand in writing Cosmos, I know. I'm not...
Contact,
yep. Yes.
That's one of their big collaborations, and it's actually kind of weird considering his other stuff, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, she's a significant force. I think, well, the main scientist on the show is the guy who's on screen all the time.
Sure.
I mean, like, Neil deGrasse Tyson is essentially the main, like, driving force behind the science of the episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes sense, because that's essentially what Carl Sagan did. And this show really is kind of, it's just another example of Neil deGrasse Tyson essentially basing his career choices on what Carl Sagan did.
Yeah.
Which is not to say that he's unoriginal. It's to say that he considers Carl Sagan's life and his works as being kind of a duty of the world of science to be understood by people who aren't scientists. I mean, Carl Sagan made it his mission to inform non-scientists of the world of science, and Neil deGrasse Tyson essentially decided to carry on that legacy.
Yeah, they have a whole thing in the first episode where Neil deGrasse Tyson pulls out Carl Sagan's calendar from like 1975. Mm-hmm. And you see in there on one date, you know, the name Neil Tyson is written in, and it's because Tyson met with Sagan. Sagan took the mm-hmm. time to sort of, you know, give a little 17-year-old Neil deGrasse Tyson a day to, I don't know, walk in Carl Sagan's footsteps or something.
Just follow him around taking pictures.
Yeah. But yeah,
Carl Sagan's dog.
Well, I mean, let's talk about, you know, pretty much just the first episode, I guess. What did you think? Did you like it? I know that you're a big fan of the original, right?
I am a big fan of the original. Like, I actually got into a conversation about this with my mom the mm-hmm. other day, because we're both, you know, science enthusiasts, and we both read a lot about stuff. And like, I consider shows like Cosmos and a lot of Discovery Channel shows to be essentially, like, unbelievably calming and relaxing experiences. And when I'm, you know, when I don't feel well, when I'm ill in some way, a show like this is really helpful, because it's stuff for me to think about, but it's not taxing in any way. Mm-hmm. Because I know the material. What I'm looking for is a depiction of a concept that is very that is succinct, that makes it like comprehensible to people who don't know it. Because when I try to explain complicated scientific concepts, I end up thinking like I don't even know how to phrase time. I don't know how to talk about time dilation. I still don't really know how to talk about time dilation. I understand how it works, but I don't know how to explain it to people who don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, shows like this, when they get things right, it's really revelatory, because when you know that they've accomplished it in a way that makes sense to people, you end up grabbing it and then stealing it and using it in conversations.
Mm-hmm.
So I watch the show very, very excitedly, and I can't say like any individual episode is great. I mean, like, it's great moment to moment. It's just unbelievably fun to watch.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, that's an interesting thing. I watched the first episode, and I started watching the second episode and wasn't able to finish it yet. But the first episode, which was the episode that Braga directed himself, I was very impressed by. I had not seen the original Cosmos. I wanted to watch it, and it's never really come up. But so I didn't really know what to expect. But then once I got into it, I was like, okay, so this is what they're doing. And like you're saying, the idea behind the show is basically kind of explaining scientific concepts to the general public, you know, and presenting them in a way which is easily accessible and which is going to try to excite people about science, in a sense. You know, like, I can totally see this show being shown to fifth graders for, like, the next, you know, 10 years at least. You know, this is going to be something that the teacher
It will replace on. Science teachers for a few decades.
You know, but with that mindset, with that being what the goal of this show is, I think that the execution is key. The execution is what sort of the entire thing rests on. And I thought it was extremely well executed. And I'm super impressed by the fact that this is done by a first-time filmmaker, a first-time director, right? I mean, Braga, he's been a writer his whole time. And to give something like this to him as his first thing, something where it's not scripted television in the traditional sense, and something where it's completely reliant on the visuals, and he just, like, hit it out of the park. I thought that the direction was exceptional, and you just sit there and watch it. I mean, that was, like, one of the things when the first preview started coming out, everyone was like, oh my God, I don't know what this is. Like, people who hadn't seen the original show. And I even asked you, I'm like, what is it? And you're like, I don't know how to describe it. And you sit there and you watch the preview for the show. And you're like, I have no idea what they're doing in this show. Like, I do not know the type of show that this is, but I'm totally going to watch it because visually it's amazing. You know,
I don't know what you're talking about at all. I mean, I consider this sort of thing to be like, I mean, this is the easiest thing to direct. The material is unbelievably strong. You can essentially you can drop all of the balls, and it's still going to be great.
No, I totally disagree. You could drop all of the balls, and you would still be interested in it because you're still interested in the subject matter. But the goal of this show is to capture the attention of people who, up until this point, couldn't care less about the concept of evolution or the concept of, you know, the age of the universe or things like that. You know what I mean? Like, you are an easy target for this show. You know, they could put a monkey in there to direct this thing and you'd still watch it. The goal is to get people who don't care about science to be completely invested in this show.
Which is why it's not unbelievably complicated. Essentially, you just make it look very pretty. You keep it tight. You don't let anything, you know, extraneous in there. You stay focused on the task. You don't deviate from the concept. And the concept is determined by the science advisors.
Yeah, I think you're selling it way short. You know, I mean, just like you were saying now, you know, you watch these things and you take comfort in them because they present ideas which you find to be difficult to explain in explainable fashion, and how you steal from them and when explaining scientific concepts to others. I mean, that right there is a big component of it. Okay, and it's and maybe that's where having, you know, writers of fiction,
science fiction
in general is beneficial because, you know, they can come up with ways to express these ideas. But then to sort of throw out any sort of traditional narrative in favor of just, like, extraordinary visuals, it's really, really impressive.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with any of the things you're saying. I'm just saying that the directing this is way easier than directing an episode of Star Trek.
Yeah, I definitely disagree, especially for someone who, you know, has written more Star Trek scripts than anyone else. I mean, you would think that would be the first thing they did. It's like, oh yeah, I'll direct this because I know what I want. You know, it'll be pretty easy for me to just go in there on this show that I created.
And well, what part of this is that you can't just go in there? Like, these episodes don't have, like, a shooting schedule.
Well, right.
Because they're largely determined by the content, and that content is shootable in a million different ways.
Well, that's,
so there's no, like...
That's what I'm saying.
Schedule. Right, so I think it's really weird to say that, like, that's impressive, because it's like,
no, it's shootable.
He kept working until it was good.
That's hard. you're making it sound like, oh yeah, this is just something that you do. You just throw it together, whatever. I mean, what you're describing is exceptionally hard, and maybe that it's just the perspective that I'm coming from, or something like that. Maybe it's the way that I would direct it compared to the way that someone else would, but. I mean, looking at, and I'm not saying that, like, if you were to give this to James Cameron and James Cameron would be like, oh, yeah, whatever, and then throw this up on screen, I'd be like, yeah, okay, well, of course James Cameron's going to throw that up on screen. What I'm saying is someone coming from the background that Brandon Braga has, someone who has gone in a very different direction creatively throughout his career to then do this. Like, I'm not saying that, you know, I can't believe that he could do something like this. I'm saying that I had no idea that he had this skill set in his toolbox, you know.
And I'm saying that if you gave it to James Cameron, he would throw up something on screen that was almost exactly the same.
Well, I disagree. I totally disagree. I think, like you're saying, there's a million options. You got to hone it until it's something. And, you know...
But you're going to end up, look, they're doing a specific thing. They're doing a thing that's determined by, like, actual facts. So when you hone it, when you sharpen this particular blade, you end up with a particular sort of blade, and it's going to look like everyone else's.
I totally disagree. I mean, even the fact that they're like, let's explain this concept by using this visual. It's like, okay. You could have chosen a million visuals to work. This one works really well.
But most of those things are determined by the actual the people involved. I mean, these are not like random inventions. I mean, like, these are the thought experiments being depicted in ways that have been depicted before.
Okay, fine. But even with that, okay, for example, in the first episode, okay, the idea of trying to demonstrate how old the universe is by fitting all of time into one calendar year, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you take that concept, which I'm sure has been done before, but is okay. First, you're investing in this idea, in this idea. Now, what you need to do is figure out a way to visually represent it, and in an exciting and very dynamic way. And you look at the way that that was shot and put together, you know, it's amazingly well done. I don't know. I mean, I think you're selling this way,
I've
way
seen
short.
These things before. That's the thing.
Maybe. And you know,
and when you're saying, like, he did a good job, I'm saying that, yeah, anyone competent would do a good job.
I think you're selling him way short.
I'm not trying to sell anyone short. I'm just saying that when you praise the director of this show, it sounds kind of weird.
I don't see why. I mean, everyone talks about, you know, visually speaking, how it looks amazing, and how you're, I mean, just like, you know, it's the job of the director to take, you know, words and translate them into visuals, and how the words
that's kind
here,
of the job of everyone.
Okay, fine, but the words here are, you know, weird in television terms, in that they're not, you know, your typical narrative. I mean, it's
sure, but it's not atypical for like a show, like a documentary series.
I think it is. I think the scale at which these stories are being told is really interesting. And I think if you look at a place where it falls apart, it's when it's small. Like, anytime you have Neil deGrasse Tyson, like, sitting in the woods, like, hanging out with some wolves, it's like, okay, yeah, Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, as far as acting is concerned, he's a really good scientist. Well, that's Cosmos for you. I think both Max and I would recommend it, correct?
Yeah.
Check it out. And, yeah, Brandon Braga's got another show coming out next month, and we will tackle that at some point in the future as well, but that might take a little bit more time since he was... I think the creator or co-creator of that show, it might require a bit more analysis. Anyway, well, it's been fun talking about X-Files and Cosmos this week, but that's not all that we're talking about on Trek.fm, so here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
A Lot Time Commentary.
He's got his 3D
room
chest.
With yeah. the weird lights. And
well, he shops at Spencer's.
Yeah, wherever that is.
Oh, poor Colin.
Oh, that joke will kill in America.
Earl Grey.
Geordi LaForge.
They're, you know, Sherlock and Watson flying in the face of copyright laws that they didn't realize at the time.
The Ready Room.
Emergence.
The entire scene that Picard and Beverly have is about one-upping each other with pointless trivia about the Orient Express that they each have. Well, did you know? Well, Beverly, I knew that, but did you know this? And it's like, what is the point of this scene? I don't...
The Orb.
Trail on Trial.
There are motifs that carry through, like
right,
your hands behind your back.
Right, exactly. And that's where I think you get the variation on a theme. You know, it's not a new song, it's not even a new verse. It's a reordering of notes to create something different and yet similar.
To the journey!
Costumes on Voyager.
Take that, Enterprise-D. That's right, you think your mind was blown in 87. Just wait until you see it in 97. Warp 5.
TOS Impressions of Seasons 1 and 2.
Once I actually started watching it, I began to understand that it was about our future leading into TOS. It's more of a sequel for us than it is a prequel for TOS.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
The X-Files, Small Potatoes.
When I get to this episode, I get excited.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the ones that I continually find more things to like about it.
Melodic Treks.
The music of a mock time.
Yeah, we can do a Muppets podcast, too. I mean, at this point, we might as well, right?
Right.
I mean, we're doing every other show.
Literary Treks.
The Return of the Serpent.
So they all shoot the dinosaur, and then they look back, and
they
the Klingon...
They all have to shoot the dinosaur.
And then the Klingon's like, no, I can't do it. I don't want to shoot him. I can't. If I do it, then I'll turn into one of those Klingons that I don't like. You mean one of the Klingons that's helpful?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows to get in on the daily Trek Talk. We have new shows for you every day, and you'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can stream and download files from the website. Just visit trek.fm/pd for podcast directory to get all the links. So, you know, Carl Sagan, he's written a bunch of books, obviously, and I actually haven't read any of them, but I have seen, it just never came up, but I have seen
Demon Haunted World.
I haven't seen that, but
it's
I've
a book.
Okay. I've seen a movie that is based on one of his books, and it's a very good movie, and that is Contact. The movie was actually ranked by NASA as the second most plausible science fiction movie of all time. Anyway, it was a book first, and you can get it for free on audible.com. Listen to the book.
Yeah.
Here's the description. The future is here. In an adventure of cosmic dimension, in December 1999, a multinational team journeys out to the stars to the most awesome encounter in human history. Who or what is out there? In Cosmos, Carl Sagan explained the universe. In Contact, he predicts its future and our own.
Yeah.
You've read this book, right?
Yeah.
Big fan?
I'm a fan.
Yeah.
I'm a fan. I mean, it's a really weird book. It's not as impeccably written like science fiction novel as you might expect from, you know, something of that profile. But it's way better than a Michael Crichton novel.
There you go. Contact. Way better than a Michael Crichton novel. Put that on the cover, Audible. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from and new titles coming every week. From classics to current bestsellers, Audible has something for everyone. As a Trek.fm listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice. along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. So give it a try today. Catch up on all those classics you've yet to read, or the latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank you and Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and Trek.fm. As always, you can find us at Trek.fm, where we do this show. I also do Standard Orbit with Drew on Trek.fm, and you can find us on CommentaryTrackStars.com, where we do Commentary Track Stars Off Topic. And you can email us at comtrackstars@gmail.com or tweet us at comtrackstars. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's pretty cool. We got the Bad Blood. We got the Cosmos. We got all that stuff. The Cliff Bowl and the Bran and Braga. And next week is part 4 in our series on Cliff Bowl, where we were going to be looking at his third X-File, Chimera.